Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
There would have been 100 live alligators needed on the set. I love the idea of, like, this is why I love first drafts, is like people do go into it with the, without that kind of practical element, without that sort of like nagging voice in your head where like, well, where are they going to get 100 alligators from? Isn't that going to be a bit of a nuisance? Let's just go all out and let my imagination run loose.
So MAT episode 17, we're going to be doing a deep dive into Nick Cage Gladiator 2 scripts. But before we get into it today, I need to do a few intros to new faces or new voices who are going to be joining us for this. We're joined by Will Kennard, who's a good pal of mine. We used to work together. You know, like most people say, they like a bit of everything in terms of music. Well, Will actually does. Like, you know, you get the headphone bleed from a colleague, and it was either drum and bass, Viking death metal, deep jazz cuts, Nick Cave, things of that nature. But yeah, and Will, you're doing some acting classes at the moment, right?
Full-time, I work in marketing, and I guess that's my thing, strategy, marketing, product. I've got a startup and I work full-time as well. But yeah, aspiring screenwriter, actor. I mean, it's been a sort of dream of mine since I was pretty young, but I've always kind of wanted to be realistic with what I'm doing with my life. So wanted to get a proper job first and try and, you know, not be totally broke for a while. And then sort of, I guess the reason I love film and I love music so much is, and I'm not really very technical with any of it, I wouldn't say at all, but yeah, the reason that I love it so much, I guess, is because I can kind of pull out the things that I really do love, and you know, I think the appreciation I have for film and music is pretty wide. Yeah, that's a pretty good intro. I think I'm one of those people who basically, if someone recommends something to me, I will actually watch it.
That's always a good trait, I think. Did I see as well you were doing some Shakespeare over Zoom the other day?
Yeah, God. So I'm doing like short courses just because I haven't really actually done proper acting for ages and ages. And when I say proper acting, I mean, you know, just anything at all. So, yeah, I've been doing a short course, and it was supposed to be 8 weeks, and halfway through, obviously, all this lockdown stuff happened. So the course was moved online, which is sort of, you know, I mean, a big part of acting is looking someone in the eyes and, you know, it's not really possible on Zoom, but it's quite cool because we were doing the tutor. He was like, you know, pretend that they had to do it over Zoom, like literally just, you know, take that Shakespeare monologue and literally do it over Zoom. So yeah, it's quite interesting to do that, but obviously it's nowhere near as sort of fun as doing proper scenes in.
Are you living by yourself at the moment, or are you with flatmates?
No, I've got a flatmate, yeah.
Are you like a nightmare to live with, just doing monologues in a lounge every day?
Yeah, it's funny because one of the girls on the course is like, she was like, I really, really want to go for it, but all my flatmates are in the other room and I'm really embarrassed. And you know, it is quite weird because you sort of stood up in front of the webcam kind of going mental at your computer, and obviously your neighbors can hear you and stuff. So yeah, it is weird, but it's fun actually. A lot more fun than I expected.
And we're also joined by Al Horner, who's a music and film journalist predominantly, or as your site beautifully puts it, Al, you've got pros in different area codes. So you've written for GQ, The Guardian, Empire magazine, among others, and Al also runs a great film podcast called Script Apart, where he speaks to screenwriters about their first drafts of scripts and how they develop and change. I saw Wired actually today put you on the 43 best podcast for curious minds, which is awesome. I have every faith we were 44, but quite make the cut. But that's awesome. But your guests so far have included Stephen Merchant, Barry Jenkins, who wrote Moonlight, the writers of Black Klansman, Armando Iannucci, Particularly enjoyed the 10 Things I Hate About You one as well, which I listened to yesterday, and the United Before Christmas one, which sort of reveals a darker side of the sort of Hollywood writing process. It sort of didn't sound like it was all fun and games there. But was this a podcast you started in lockdown?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was actually an idea that I've been kicking around for a while. Like, me and my producer, is a guy called Cam Dimmock, who's a filmmaker. And yeah, we've been talking about it for about a year, but I guess like pre-corona life was just so hectic that we never had a moment to kind of get it started. And then, of course, March came along and lockdown happened, and suddenly there was just kind of a moment of stillness to start this podcast, hopefully kind of raise a bit of money for some great charities in the meantime. And and also just kind of selfishly, as a screenwriter myself, have an excuse to kind of very sneakily get some tips for my screenplays from the best in the business. So it was a lockdown project, but its origin was before that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, first drafts can be a difficult thing to give up. I think I came across a script I wrote at uni, which was absolutely horrific to read. But have you ever had somebody just really not comfortable with doing it and they've turned it down for that reason? Or are mostly people open and willing to look back on something that's become a success?
Yeah, we've been really, really lucky in that so far all the guests have been really, really willing to open themselves up, because as you say, like, first drafts, a first draft is your like mad splurge of imagination when the idea is kind of really raw and really new, and often it's pretty kind of wild and it's kind of riddled with like kind of like plot holes and character arcs that don't go to the right places and all this kind of thing. And it's that I mean, with the exception of some people like Barry Jenkins, who, when he came on the show, he was just like, I just went to Europe, and he sent me the first draft, and I was kind of like, no, your first draft. And he was like, that is the first draft. And I was like, oh, okay.
Wow.
He had just kind of gone to Belgium and drank a bunch of whiskey and like knocked out this immaculate Best Picture winning screenplay, which was great. But for the most part, for the rest of us who aren't Barry Jenkins, it's your first draft is always a little bit scrappy and a little messy, and there's definitely vulnerability involved in coming on the show. And we've been really, really lucky that so far all these great guests have been kind of really up for sharing those mistakes and kind of delving into how they corrected those mistakes to make stories all tick. So it's been really fun so far.
I think that's a great thing about your pod as well, because I think particularly when you first come into things, you always feel like you're going to write your masterpiece on day one, but usually it takes a long time, you know, if you ever get there. But I think I'm always interested in the mistakes and how things are corrected and how they're improved, but it really gives a great insight into that, and has kept me company throughout lockdown, so I've been really enjoying it. We've of course got all you guys on to do a bit of a deep dive into Nick Cage's Gladiator 2 script, which has become this sort of figure of silver screen, could have been legend. And I guess it's a bit of a different one for you, Al, on Scripts Apart, as your pod tends to take a look at what's changed, what didn't, and why on its journey. And this particular example is a little stuck at that early stage of development, like you were just talking about.
This never went past the first draft. The first stage. And I mean, when I spoke before about like first drafts sometimes being wild and full of kind of like unrestrained imagination, this is Gladiator 2 Christ Killer, to give it down in movie lore a little bit, as being just this like absolutely batshit insane sequel to an unsequelable film. As crazy as you can imagine. So it's definitely we could do 10 podcasts on the madness of the film.
I do feel that is a good way to put Gladiator. It probably is up there, top 20 of the most unsequable films, if I like that term. So true.
Have you guys seen any of Nick Cave's films that he scripted? I know there's A Proposition and Lawless. Or have you guys seen 20,000 Days on Earth or One More Time of Feeling?
I have seen The Proposition. I really like The Proposition. I haven't seen Lawless, and I really should, because I think that's John Hillcoat, director, who also did The Road, which I 100% have still not recovered from. I've seen basically all of Nick's films apart from Lawless. For some reason, it's just some blind spot for me. And of course, I've loved his music for a long, long time and read his books as well. So yeah, he's the definition of a polymath, isn't he?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, something I always love and respect about him is he's able to wield his pen to so many things: scripts, songwriting, novels, poetry, soundtracks as well. Some are like hilarious, some are bizarre, some are devastating. He really is like a jack of all trades. And it seems when he's talking about this film, Gladiator 2, he really saw it as a challenge first and foremost. And I guess it's almost the ultimate challenge for a writer. The sequel, The Gladiator, which was that rare beast as well, that's a real critical and commercial success. It was the second biggest film of 2000. It won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Actor. So yeah, it's a challenge to say the least. And sequels in themselves are sort of difficult beasts to tame. I sort of feel like, Al, you could do a sequel special at some point on your pod.
Yeah, we've got a couple of sequels sort of in the pipeline. And I'm really looking forward to having those conversations with the screenwriters involved, because yeah, as you say, there really is like a tricky task when it comes to writing a good sequel, which is why historically there have been very few satisfying ones. And I think that's kind of changed somewhat a little bit lately. Now Hollywood has this model of creating franchises, which means studios rarely greenlight films now that don't feel like their stories could be continued and serialized and turned into cinematic universes and all that kind of thing. So I feel like if a film like Gladiator was being made today, before it was greenlit in the first place, they'd probably be looking to, you know, how could Gladiator stretch across 3 films? The problem facing Nick and anyone trying to do a sequel, right, is that like films are kind of, academically and within screenwriting, they discuss like films being about metamorphosis. So a character starts the movie in one state or with one worldview, and then good films, like our beloved films, they often follow this structure, right, of having like that worldview challenged, and then through hardship, determination and struggle, the character arrives at like a new state or a new kind of worldview at the end. And once you kind of like gain that perspective, you see it in everything, like, you know, in Finding Nemo, the dad fish is super protective of his kid. Great film. Nick Cave should definitely write a sequel. Then Nemo goes missing, and he goes through the hardship of having to find Nemo, and he comes out of it with this realization that if you love something, you got to set it free and not be so overbearing and all this kind of thing. And with sequels, a great example I love of that is like Die Hard. The entire point of Die Hard is for a man to realize that he loves his wife, and the action is kind of like how he arrives at that kind of realization and that sort of reconciliation, I suppose. So a good film kind of takes a character from A to B. And with sequels, you've already gone from A to B, the character arc is already complete, and you might have like a bigger budget to do more explosive set pieces and all that kind of thing, but often there's, where does your character go emotionally? And sometimes it doesn't matter. So like sometimes they just like reset. And I mean, Han Solo realizes his selfish ways and swoops in to help at the end of A New Hope, but then basically resets and is a bit of a selfish bastard again at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back. But generally that's the problem and the challenge of sequels, that and like the tricky task of your audience having certain expectations from the first movie.
Yeah.
And on one hand, when you're writing a sequel, it's like, well, the audience wants us to hit some of these similar beats and they want more of what they loved about the first film. How do you do that without it being just a retread? How do you give them something new at the same time? And Gladiator 2 is just Nick kind of like essentially like not really giving a shit about retreading or bring on any of those like beats from the first film. It might as well be a completely original original idea, original property. It's just like, cool, Christ killer, here we go.
It's interesting the way you put that, because obviously this is music amongst other things, and you can see the similarities in what you said about sequels and stuff, and you know, to musicians, you know, bringing out second, third, fourth albums, like they probably face a similar thing where, you know, our audience that we've built loves the style of music, but we want to go a completely different direction. What's the risk of doing that? Will they come on that ride with us, or will they just completely kind of separate themselves?
Especially when there's some sort of like commercial success involved. Like, do I give the people what they want?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like how do you balance out what your audience expects from you with like what should be like an artistic impulse to kind of move forward? Not everyone gets that right, but yeah.
And I guess that's probably like before we were talking about, you know, sequels, like, oh, not another sequel. Those are the sequels that get it wrong, where at the end of the day, the first film, when you're looking at the sequel, like you say, it is just a recipe of success. You've got it in front of you. You can take the bits that worked well, you can ignore the bits that didn't work. And I guess the worst sequels in kind of film history, and probably albums to a degree, are the ones that kind of do the exact same thing but just don't do anything. Like, they don't do anything original. It's kind of like, I know they're not sequels, but it's kind of like the remakes of these Disney films that we're seeing coming out every year. You know, that we're doing kind of the recipes of success, they're doing all the songs that people like, but we're not building on it, we're not taking risks or anything. And so maybe the best sequels out there are the ones that kind of take ingredients that worked, but then they're like, fuck it, we're going to put something even better in there as well, which I guess you can see that Nick Kay's obviously trying to be a bit bold.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a bit too much.
Not to take things on too much of a tangent, but man, you know what is a really good film to look at from that perspective? And in my opinion, a really good sequel. Back to the Future 2.
Right.
It's so interesting when you rewatch that film from the perspective of it commenting on like the expectations and the challenges of sequels. So I don't know how, you know, I don't know if any of you guys have rewatched Back to the Future 2 recently, but essentially it's like they redo the first film. Like the third act of Back to the Future 2 is Marty running around the climax of Back to the Future 1, and it's really interesting. It recycles so many of the beats from the first film, I suppose.
Yeah,
in like a sort of interesting kind of meta way that there was the Blank Check podcast, which is so good. I really recommend anyone watches it. He's got like nerdy interest and all this kind of thing. They did an episode on it recently that kind of like explored the idea of Back to the Future 2 kind of having its cake and eating it. It's a comment
on,
you know, the difficulty of trying to do a sequel and trying to move forward while audiences or like large chunks of audiences all want, you know, a repeat of the first film. Or they think they want.
Yeah.
They're disappointed when they're actually served it up.
Also, I was thinking with Back to the Future Part 2, even though they got the hoverboards and stuff wrong, they actually almost predicted the Hollywood's appetite for sequels. Because I remember there was like an advertisement for Jaws 7 or something, if I recall. So they got a couple of things right. Maybe not the hoverboards and that.
They got 2015, Trump right, man. They got Cannon is Trump in that. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
The paradox. But yeah.
In terms of the backstory for this particular project, it seems that Russell Crowe originally approached Nick to pen the script to Gladiator 2. So apparently they're friends. There was a plan to commission John Logan, who was a writer on the first one, to write a sequel which would be set in ancient Rome, but it wouldn't feature either Crowe or Gladiators. But apparently Crowe just wanted to be in it, so he sort of got Nick Cave involved.
He needed a mate to write it.
But he... So Nick Cave recalled the conversation he had with Crowe I think he asked him, didn't you die in Gladiator 1? And he asked, yeah, you just sorted it out. So still quite a blasé exchange. But it's sort of funny to imagine Nick Cave sitting there watching Gladiator 1, writing notes like, how the fuck am I going to bring Russell Crowe back from the dead?
Would Nick Cave have been paid for this? Would it just have been like, do this for fun and then we'll see where it goes?
That's a good question. What do you reckon, Al? I don't know if you've got any intel on how that sort of thing works.
I imagine he was paid in the currency of not having Russell Crowe mad at you. Like, if Russell Crowe tells you to write a script, you go ahead and write that script, okay? Like, I don't know. I think it was like, I don't know. It would hazard a guess not. It doesn't seem like this was something at the studio's behest, although, yeah, as you mentioned, like, it was a massive hit, so they would have been keen to explore options when it came to, like, sequel ideas. I know even, like, Ridley Scott was quite keen and sort of, like, he's spoken quite warmly about, like, exploring the idea, but the idea being, in terms of, like, Nick's idea, but the idea being kind of completely unmarketable and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get onto that later for sure, because I think that would be an absolute nightmare for marketing purposes. But but Will, you told me you watched the director's cut of Gladiator the other day, so you might be best placed to tell us where things were left at the end of Gladiator 1, or maybe just like an overview if you got that. Didn't you say it was like 17 hours long?
Jeez. Yeah, you know those like director's cuts that are, you know, post 3 hours long kind of thing. The end is sort of, yeah, I mean, it's like he's dead, but the way that Nick Cave has moved the script for Gladiator 2 into this kind of hybrid of afterlife type thing, does kind of follow on, because obviously he kills the Caesar dude, I can't remember what his first name is, but his kind of right hand man. You know, is sort of the one who says at the end, you know, we'll see you soon, but like...
Oh, is that, but not yet, not yet, yeah.
Yeah, not yet. Quote. Kind of like, well, yeah, he's dead, but he's left it. I mean, it's not open-ended, right? Because what he's saying is, I'm going to die at some point as well. And I think there's themes throughout the film, you know, kind of that go with sort of stoicism and things like that. And it's very, it is a very stoic film. And obviously, they talk about Marcus Aurelius and things like that. So I think the end of the film isn't really open-ended at all. But, so it's quite funny how, yeah, obviously, the stuff we're going to talk about kind of what's going through Nick Cave's head when he's thinking, how can we, how can we take this and make it into that character being on screen again?
I think that's where the real challenge is. I mean, and he seems to thrive on those sort of challenges. I think he said in an interview that whenever he's done something new, it's always because somebody's asked him and he just wants to challenge himself. But I mean, towards the end of Gladiator 1, it looks like, you know, Maximus throughout the film is, you know, always has these visions of his wife and child. And it looks like he's on the way to be rejoined with them. But instead, at the start of Nick Cage Gladiator 2, he wakes up in a sort of purgatory. It's not really said what it exactly is, but it's not the outcome that you expect. But it's described as a vast, sodden wilderness. And Mordecai, who is this ghostly figure who guides him on his journey throughout the film, there's a scene where these refugee camps sit in squalor by a black sea, and he describes a fog hanging lifelessly over the dark, motionless water. But Mordecai describes the sort of people there as two types of people. There are those who search and those who have given up the search. The former in time always becomes the latter. The search is to hope, and well, here there is no hope. So pretty bleak, it sounds. Maximus is given this mission by the Roman gods to neutralize Hephaestus, who is a Greek god, which is sort of a questionable placing, but I'm sure there's something behind it. But he's a Greek god of blacksmiths, metalworking, carpenters. And he's a Roman god who's turned against his fellow Roman gods to Christianity. that's shown up and sweeping the land on Earth. The Roman gods basically ask him to neutralize him in exchange for a path to paradise where he'd be reunited with his wife and child. And I guess this meeting with the Roman gods is one of the first eyebrow raises, thinking just from, you know, if it's come across someone's desk. So Maximus enters the dim confines of the temple. Rain leaks through the broken stonework and runs down the walls. A large torch wheel hangs from the ceiling on a chain. It swings and creaks. Seven dissolute old men, Jupiter, Apollo, Pluto, Neptune, Mars, Mercury, Bacchus, cluster around a makeshift table, their heads craned towards each other as they mumble amongst themselves. Maximus stands before them. The old men grow silent. They look ill and diseased. The torch wheel creaks. Jupiter, fat eyes boiled and bloodshot, sits in the center. He looks at Maximus and pushes the other old men away. And this is sort of the introduction to, you know, the Roman gods. And the plot sort of revolves around the death of the Roman gods and the growing tide of Christianity, which rose up in the fringes of the Roman Empire in the second and third century, which I think is such a cool concept. And, you know, very Nick Cave, because he's very infatuated with religion. I find it funny that he describes the gods as seven dissolute old men. I think that's an amazing way of putting it. And for some reason, when I was imagining the scene, I pictured Brian Blessed sort of in an Eddie Murphy Nutty Professor style playing every character of the Roman gods. I don't know why, but that sort of popped to me first. But yeah, so I mean, religion of course weighs very heavy over the scripts. I mean, how did you find that that first initial meet with the Roman gods? Because, well, correct me if I'm wrong, aside from the visions of the afterlife and the path to his wife and child, there's not too many elements of the supernatural in Gladiator 1. Is that right?
No, not really at all. I mean, it's very religious, but it's not. Yeah, I don't think you could call any of it like supernatural. I think on a surface level you might do, but you know, it's obviously supposed to be. Particularly the end scene is obviously supposed to be his. You know, it's in his head. He's fading away, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, at least that's the way I saw it.
Yeah, no, definitely. What did you make of this scene? I think the depiction of deities and gods in films can, I guess, be quite a, you know, questionable subject, or just hard to imagine when reading the script. But how do you feel like this compared to maybe other examples, if you have any?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose this is where you could draw a link to the first film in that there was. I mean, it's been a while since I went back to Gladiator, but I do sort of remember sort of like, you know, he dies, this sort of Christ-like sacrifice. I don't know. There were Christian elements threaded through that film. It's interesting kind of like, I wouldn't necessarily call myself like a Nick Cave, like I'm a big fan, but I don't know whether I'd be able to call myself like an expert on his work, because man,
yeah,
some people whose devotion to him is, well, yeah, religious, appropriately enough for this. So. it's interesting from the stuff that I know of Nick, like religion has always kind of like floated around in his work as a theme, often because like there's quite a lot of depravity as well, especially in like, you know, books like The Death of Bunny Monroe. And yeah, I think he's always had like this kind of religion has often been like the binary. It's often been like the like dualism, like the other to his kind of like main character in Bunny Monroe being this kind of sex mate. So like it's interesting to sort of see these things pop up in Gladiator 2, given what we know of the rest of Nick's work. It's obviously something that he thinks about and that has preoccupied his thoughts from time to time.
Well, he wrote an introduction actually to the new version of the Gospel called Mark, or the New Testament, which unveils some really interesting stuff as to why it inspires him. He speaks first of the Old Testament. He said, I had a burgeoning interest in violent literature coupled with an unnamed sense of the divinity in things. And in my early 20s, the Old Testament spoke to that part of me that railed and hissed and spat at the world. It's a wonderful, terrible book, and it was sacred scripture. You know, most people find it angst in like a Tarantino film, but obviously it wasn't enough for Nick Cave. But he also consistently comes from a place of creativity when he's talking about religion. Because he goes on to say, Christ came as a liberator. Christ understood that we as humans were forever held to the ground by the pull of gravity, our ordinariness, our mediocrity. And it was through his example that he gave our imaginations the freedom to fly. And he also spoke about this on one of his other Red Hand files, where he uses these really beautiful, inexpensive words, but sums up these very massive, challenging concepts in an amazing way. But the exact thing he says is, I haven't the stomach for atheism and its insistence on what we know. It feels like a dead end to me, unhelpful and bad for the business of writing. For some reason, because he's always tied to folklore and, you know, these sort of grand myths and legends, I always feel like Nick Cave would write a really good Pirates of the Caribbean film.
He could also star in it. I think he could pull that off. I can see him.
Oh, man, yeah.
With a peg leg.
In terms of the next phase of the scripts, I mean, he finds Hephaestus. It's here where he mentions Maximus's son, who is, of course, we assume dead, but he says he's in danger. He stands before a great storm in his hand. The nub of truth is the phrase he uses. So, I mean, the way he actually comes back to Earth, I mean, the exact way it happens is Maximus rises out of the body of a dying Christian, which is a hell of an entry. Will, it sort of seems up your street, this sort of, you know, wild way of getting this character back to Earth.
I mean, I think almost like it's kind of a bit like when I was thinking about this, it's sort of like impossible to not, in my mind, see it as a B movie, like, which is really bad.
Definitely mad B movie vibe. But also it would have been like,
yeah,
crazy expensive to do. So yeah, it would have not been a B-movie budget.
But it's like the way that it's brought in is just like kind of ridiculous. Like, you know, pretty much. And I don't know if there's kind of two ways that could be played on in terms of direction and how the end product would work. But, you know, it's like it could be taken into itself very, very seriously or completely the opposite. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, do you acknowledge that and yeah, like you're completely going against like really what the original film was.
At this point in the film, 2 decades have passed since the face-off in the Colosseum, as time moves differently in Purgatory, and he's arrived right in the heart of a bloody massacre led by Lucius, who is a boy in the first film. He's the nephew of Commodus. He's around 13 years old, I think, in the first one. But he's introduced as the main antagonist, who's wreaking havoc among these Christians at the behest of the Emperor Decius. I mean, what are our first impressions of Lucius? Because he sort of cuts quite a mean figure straight away. I don't know what your thoughts were, Al.
Yeah, I think like this whole section seems pretty in keeping with what we've seen so far and the kind of general madness of it. It's hard that Joaquin Phoenix's character in the first film was just so brilliantly hateable, and it's difficult kind of carving out an antagonist that can match that. And I think a lot of that magic was in the script, but a lot of it was in the performance as well. And it's obviously interesting that it's a character who's sort of brought back from the first film. Nick is kind of scurrying around trying to find ways to link madcap creation or what's supposed to have happened before. Pretty interesting.
I think Phoenix is it was funny because obviously I hadn't seen Gladiator for so long. I've watched, you know, You Were Never Really Here. Is it You Were Never Really Here? Or
They Were Never? Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
You know, that's been one of my favourite films since I've seen it. And, you know, a couple of other things, Joker and things like that he's been in that have just, you know, almost kind of The Master and stuff like that. Just sort of, he's definitely one of my favourite actors and, you know, definitely a sort of, almost like a role model for me. And then to see him as such an absolute turd in the original Gladiator. He is the perfect turd in the original, and he's almost every aspect of him is is dislikable.
Yeah,
he's so brilliantly plays it. I don't know if I've seen something, you know, as well done as that before.
Yeah. Kind of, it's one of those brilliant kind of creations as an antagonist that's like, it's not sort of there's reason for it, and it's antagonism that's rooted in something relatable. Like, it's all based out of that character's insecurity and his sort of hate for the fact that he doesn't feel his dad loves him, and he doesn't feel like he's the son that his dad wanted him to be. And as much as you hate him in that film, you understand where those emotions are coming from, because he wants to be loved, and he wants to be loved by this man who just looks so admiringly at Maximus the entire way through the first act. So, I just love as like, villain creation. That's like such a sweet spot to hit, and you don't see it so often. It was just so brilliantly in the first Gladiator.
In terms of the next phase of the script, Mordecai informed Maximus that his son Marius was returned to Earth, sacrifice of his mother's, and Maximus sets about tracking him down. He finds out he's a Christian who are also, obviously being purged by the Roman Empire, and this is a sort of great storm he faces. I know you were just talking about connections to Gladiator 1, but Maximus is reacquainted with Jabba at one point in a sort of a bar or a pub. It's quite an interesting bit of dialogue, actually, where Maximus is retelling the story and Jabba says, "Forgive me, friend, but truly these are the kind of stories I tell my children." So maybe there's like a little insecurity propping up there, if you know what I mean. But I mean, from here, Maximus finds his son and helps protect him along with the other Christians, which sort of goes against his initial mission from the Roman gods, where they sort of wanted to wipe out Christianity. And the Christians are pretty hard done by in this film, like the wild alligator scene in the Colosseum. Will, I sent you that little section. Do you reckon you could give us a reading of it in your finest Shakespearean Zoom voice?
With pleasure.
perfect.
So this is, external the Colosseum, Rome, midday. The Colosseum teems with people. The people scream and cheer and shout at the carnage they witness in the arena. The grounds of the arena have been flooded, and in 4 foot of water, a naval battle ensues. The water roils with 100 alligators that have been released in the water. 100 specifically. Gladiators fire arrows, throw spears, launch fireballs as the two vessels approach each other. Christians kneel on the decks, hands clasped in prayer. Some Christians, impaled on spears and arrows, fall from the vessels and are torn apart by the alligators. Decius and his retinue? I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
Yeah, retinue.
Watch the proceedings with blood-hungry delight. Decius rises to his feet and cheers as a fireball explodes on the deck of one of the vessels. Lucius makes his way through the retinue towards Decius. Decius sees Lucius and beckons him over. Decius, look about you, Lucius. The people are pleased. A roar goes up as the two vessels collide and gladiators leap from one vessel to the other, hacking and thrusting their spears.
I mean, that's truly probably one of the most wild sequences in the film, apart from the ending, which we'll get onto. But I know you love these sort of big, batshit crazy battle sequences. Was this, you know, up your street?
Definitely, yeah. And I think obviously the comments. Actually, you know, I hope I'm imagining that in some weird world, Nick Cave might be listening to this, and I kind of feel bad. Or good, I don't know. Maybe he intended it to feel like a B-movie. But yeah, this is definitely B-movie vibes. And
to be fair, I couldn't help, but when it's mentioned earlier on in the film, it's a part where, remind me, Sean, someone says, oh, they're even talking about flooding the Colosseum, like, because it's getting too boring. It's earlier, way earlier in the film. I was kind of like, you know, when they were hinting at alligators, part of me was like, oh, can't wait for that bit. I knew it was coming because they've kind of hinted at it. And so when I saw your notes, like, oh, this is the page with the alligator scene, by the way, I was like, right, go straight to that. I thought it was quite gripping.
going through Nick Cave's head when he's writing this? Is he kind of laughing to himself and thinking, you know, fuck it, like, let's just go for it, like,
yeah, that's what, kind of thing. That's what I love about it, though, this sort of, you know, unchained sort of creativity, which one, you get in first drafts, like you say, Al, but also particularly if you're approaching the sequel, that, you know, I think he did say in an interview he wrote it with every knowing in every ounce of his body that it was never going to get made. So, yeah, you know, I think there is definitely elements where he's definitely having fun with it. But you're right, Neil, with the alligator scene, because they do mention it earlier. I think Jabba says something along the lines of, basically, there wasn't many ticket sales, so they wanted to up the ante a bit, which almost links to the problem with the sequel. Do you know what I mean? You've got to go bigger and bolder in the sequel. Yeah. You know, you can't just have gladiators fighting. You need alligators, vessels, and 4 foot of water.
What I love about that so much is, and you are right, like, often what I hear from filmmakers reflecting back on scripts is you almost have to approach it as if it will never be made, because let me get the timeline right. So the first Gladiator, I remember, had those tigers in the Colosseum, and of course this was a time where I think their CGI budget was maxed out by trying to like CG together the scenes with that character. I can't remember who it was from the first film who died midway through the shoot, so they had to try and
I think it was Oliver Reed
that
passed away. Yeah.
But basically, like, I think this was before you could really do animals convincingly in CG. I mean, I don't know necessarily whether you can now in a lot of cases. Yeah. There would have been 100 live alligators needed on the set. I love the idea of, like, this is why I love first drafts, is like people do go into it without that kind of practical element, without that sort of like nagging voice in your head where, like, well, where are they going to get 100 alligators from? Isn't that going to be a bit of a nuisance? You know what I mean? So, like, it's a I can definitely believe when you say that Nick wrote this from like a mindset of like, fuck it, never gonna be made, let's just go all out and let my imagination run loose.
I'm more interested in just imagining Russell Crowe reading it. That's what makes me laugh. It's just imagining just him reading it, just being like, just, I don't know, like 1 a.m. in his study, just being like, what the fuck is he going on?
I imagine him calmly taking out a red pen, writing on the corner of the script, only 100? Could we have more alligators?
Yeah. The alligators. 101.
Yeah. Where are the sharks?
Yeah,
it seems like he has that like attitude as well, Russell Crowe, because I saw an interview with him where he was talking about Gladiator and talking about the fact that the first film was actually almost, I think it had something like 21 pages of script when they were actually starting to shoot. So a lot of it was almost improvised. And, you know, at one point he just turns to Ridley Scott and just says, do you mind if I decapitate someone in the scene? And obviously there's quite a lot of logistics involved. But, you know, but obviously I'm sure he's getting into the character in that, but there was almost like no reason behind it. But I can, like you say, I'll definitely imagine him up in the sort of quantity of alligators in that scene. In terms of the next stage of the scripts, so Marius's adoptive father, Cassian, who's a teacher and a ringleader of the Christians, he's ousted and murdered by Lucius. Marius flees to hiding with the other Christians in the town, where Maximus helps him build a battle strategy and forge weapons with Jabba's help for a sort of final showdown. And there is a face-off between Maximus and Lucius prior to the battle. But this final battle takes place in a forest where Lucius and his followers are attacked against one of the Christians' sort of traditional non-violent approach. They go hardened into battle with the help of Maximus. Eventually they defeat Lucius. And as a Christian, faith continues to spread and, you know, not die. And technically, Maximus doesn't fulfill his mission for the Roman gods. The last sequence is a truly wild climax of the film. as it finds Maximus battling for the rest of eternity while Christianity still exists. So it starts with the War of the Crusaders. It then goes into World War One or World War Two. You then have this incredible line where it says, Maximus stands in the middle of another battlefield. Armored tanks bear down, automatic weapons. Maximus fights, soldiers fall around him. Then he's in Vietnam, jungle, carnage, choppers, flamethrowers. And then the last scene, which Neil really would love for you to read out, is at the Pentagon in Washington.
Yeah, didn't expect this location. Interior, bathroom, Pentagon, Washington. Close up of Maximus rubs a cake of soap between his hands under a steaming tap. Maximus looks up. He is in a clean, sterile men's room. He washes his hands in a basin. The basin is one of three in a row. As he does so, he stares into the mirror above the basin. Maximus looks at himself for a long time. He stares deep into his reflected eyes. He is dressed in a crisp black suit and wears a tie, which is a very odd thought. He continues to look at himself. He turns off the tap. He dries his hands on the towel. He looks back into the mirror. Is it Mordecai? Mordecai is standing behind him. Standing behind him. Maximus. Mordecai. Yes, Maximus. Until eternity itself has said its prayers. Maximus adjusts his tie. He moves out of the bathroom, leaving Mordecai behind. Hallway. Maximus walks down a hallway under neon lights. He passes a secretary who carries an armful of documents. He opens the door. Interior room in Pentagon, Washington. Maximus enters room. There is a large circular table. 10 men in suits sit around the table. They have each have a laptop open in front of them. There is a bank of screens along one wall. Maximus sits down at the table in a black, high-backed leather chair. Maximus, excuse me, gentlemen. Maximus looks at his laptop, then looks up at the other 10 men. Maximus, now, where were we? The end.
I mean, you strange, definitely don't expect to hear the phrase cake of soap or laptop or neon lights in a gladiator script.
Or tie.
And allegedly, you know, Nick Cave recalls Russell Crowe's response to that amazing climax of scripts and the ending. It was four words. Don't like it, mate. So, I mean, I have so many questions for that last bit. I mean, like you say, that you know, real carefree, wild attitude to the script really sort of climaxes at this point. But first one that jumped to mind was, you know, if Maximus is still going, would he be on the Biden or Trump campaign?
He'd be on his own.
It'd be Maximus 2020 campaign. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, Al, how did you you know, read this ending? Because I think this is almost like the peak of the, you know, the sort of wild creativity that Nick Cave seems to ensure across this whole script.
Yeah, I mean, I am a real sucker for, like, my personal tastes are often I often prefer things that make, like, that swing big and miss, yeah, rather than sort of like, you know, take the easy route. So like, I love this. I don't think it misses. I think it's really fun and really mad and insane and brilliant. So it's kind of right up the street in terms of like the kind of like, I guess, like fuck you to rules and convention that like often govern Hollywood, and especially governs like big sequels. So yeah, I mean, I love this sort of time hopping element to it. It's it just like adds another thing to the giant bonfire of insane ideas going on in this film. So I mean, is it missing a scene in space? That's my only criticism.
how does this sort of compare to other ones that you might have read? Because, you know, I assume obviously there would have been, if it was going to be made, there'd be a lot of rewrites and rehashing, but you know, what did you think of the overall story and the plot, the writing?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was brilliant fun and like exactly the sort of imagination that's sometimes lacking, and especially so in sequels. I feel like had this gone ahead, and as I mentioned at the beginning, I think like Ridley Scott and co did do their best to kind of like make that as feasible as possible. It would have, as you say, like the sheer pragmatism and the sort of like budgets of Hollywood would have necessitated a bunch of rewrites, and things would have, it would have been streamlined, it would have come down. It again, because this was like a time before you know, like this sort of convincing technology that we're seeing in things like The Mandalorian now, where digitally you can sort of like create a background and then have actors working in front of it, and it's all very kind of like seamless. This, of course, like to create all those sets and all that, you know, all that kind of thing, it would have been such an undertaking that I think, like, even with like a massive property like Gladiator, which had been so successful, I do think that the studio would have said, like, well, but look at the first one, like, just it's Romans, just give more Romans. Can we just do it simple? You know, it would have been there. That's where the sort of tensions would have begun to creep in, and
you just need to find some like crazy venture capitalist to back this film. I think the guy is out there who wants this film made. I think it could still be made.
Yeah,
I was trying to think, like, what, you know, what is there a film that's comparable to that? The only one that comes to mind for me is one of my favorite films ever, and just because I'm a fan of the comic still, it is Dredd. And, you know, the original Judge Dredd was essentially kind of butchered, and I don't know if you've heard about the story about John Wagner that was sitting in the cinema with his daughter in the premiere, and his name was, and he was kind of the creator of Judge Dredd, if you don't know, but he was sort of one of the last people on the whole of the credits, and sort of sat there waiting for his name. And they did it as a bit of a sort of fuck you, because he wouldn't work on the film because it was totally away from the comic. And then,
oh, really?
Yeah. And then Dredd, which is, I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen Dredd, but it's one of my favorite films, because it's almost like, you know, let's just do this. Like, we know that people aren't going to like it, and it absolutely bombed in the cinema. Like, we know the masses aren't going to like it, but fuck it, let's do it properly. And I think it cost, you know, it wasn't cheap, but it wasn't ridiculous. I think the budget was about 45 million pounds. So it was sort of, you know, not massive, but pretty big. And they kind of pulled it off. Like, they really did. They sort of went, you know, let's just do a proper Dredd film. I mean, a sort of a superhero comic book film that is extremely violent and a 15 is something that probably just doesn't really get looked at. And I was just trying to think if there's any other films like that, you know, they're really a kind of like, fuck you. And, you know, that's why they're so good, like, because there's just so much heart put into it that they're not thinking about all those things about, you know, whether it's going to resonate with this audience or that audience, and, you know, what should we take out? And it's just totally, you know, itself. And this sort of scene is like something that, you know, you just love to get made, and like almost have, yeah, like a, if you had like a venture capitalist who was like, do you know what? I will just fund this film. Like, I have enough money. My life goal is to watch this film be made, like, and, you know, have my name in the credits and have it live on as this weird thing that was actually created. Like, that'd be absolutely amazing.
Oh, it'd be incredible. I mean, maybe we should start at MAOT GoFundMe or fundraiser. Actually,
yeah, because they're doing a Dredd series apparently on Netflix. I think it's either Netflix or Amazon. But I don't know if you saw, a guy made a campaign for Dredd 2. So,
oh, amazing!
And he did it on Facebook, and it got loads and loads of followers. And then Carl Urban, who was Dredd in the film, somehow got behind it and did like a little video clip saying, "Yeah, let's go for it." And yeah, it got picked up. So they're kind of they're gonna actually make a Dredd sort of sequel series. So it could be
incredible.
You know, we could get this film. We could get this film.
We could get it out there. Let's throw it down now. Let's get it. Let's get the word spread. But I mean, it also would be quite fun. I feel like we should do it, but under the condition that it's the verbatim scripts. You can't change anything. It's got to be 100 alligators.
Unless they want to add a space scene. That's the only change they can make.
With the alligators.
I like it. That's the cool. Yeah, there's got to be alligators. Well, amazing. Thanks so much for joining, guys. That was a mammoth deep dive into Gladiator 2. Everybody's got to go check out Al's podcast, Script Apart.
And watch out for Will Kennard on Shakespeare Zoom in the future. And we'll join you for the next one. Thanks so much for joining, guys. Really appreciate it.
Nice one.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. Hope you enjoyed that. Links to Al's podcast and things that we spoke about in the description, along with some playlists too. If you enjoyed that, then you might enjoy our interview with Matt Biffer, a music supervisor for TV and film, who actually placed Nick Cave's song "O Children" in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 in that famous dance scene. Here's a little clip of him discussing the decision. Give us a follow on MEAT Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and we'll catch you for the next one. Cheers, guys.
Radiohead worked, actually, but Radiohead basically works with anything. But, you know, I sort of started to set myself this thing that it had to be something that hadn't been used before in a TV show or in a film or something like that. And "O Children" was just this thing that I think it was literally the first thing that I thought about, because I'd been hoarding that song since 2004, or whenever, you know, Abattoir Blues came out, the Lyre of Orpheus or whatever. I sort of felt quite strongly about that song, so I knew I was only ever going to put it forward for something that was really going to do it sort of justice. Do you know what I mean? And that whole lyric about, you know, getting on the train to the kingdom and all that kind of stuff, like, just worked with, you know, when Harry sort of dies and is in St. Pancras or wherever, and he says to Dumbledore, well, you know, and Dumbledore says, well, I should think, if you want, you should board a train. And Harry goes, but where would I go? And Dumbledore goes, on, you know. And I sort of realized that actually I'd accidentally sort of echoed that a bit in that song as well. I wish I could say to you that it was all part of one incredibly cohesive sort of thing, and that I knew exactly what I was doing, but that was a sort of a welcome bonus, really.